And we're back here on Unusual Sources. And as promised before the break there, I am speaking with David Heap from the Gaza's Ark Steering Committee in London, Ontario. So, David, thanks very much for being on the program today.
Thanks for calling me, Brendan.
Listen, first, I want to convey my condolences and also on behalf of the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War about your father, Dan Heap. His work is known in the Toronto area especially, but also in South Ontario. I was just wondering, for those of us who may be less familiar with your father's work, could you tell us a little bit about the kind of activism he was involved in?
I would say, to be fair, he was an activist who was a politician for part of his career. But he trained as an Anglican priest, and he was ordained. But he decided after a couple of years in the early 50s that he didn't want to work for the church. So he worked as an industrial worker in a box plant in Toronto. It was actually his longest held job in the 50s and 60s. Became involved in his trade union, which was at that time Pulp Sulphite. It later became CEP, and I guess it's now Unifor, so one of Canada's biggest unions. But he was always interested in the core issues that were peace and jobs, and he really saw the importance of a peaceful economy that kept people working on productive things. From his first venture into intellectual politics in 1968, when he ran unsuccessfully in Spadina riding in Toronto, and then later he was elected as a city councillor in the early 70s and as an MP eventually in the same riding in the early 80s, and he stayed until 93. But even when he retired, in the 90s, he was very active on refugee rights, which had been one of his major focuses as an MP. Refugees from everywhere, but in particular with a particular interest in Latin America and Central America, but also on housing issues. He was involved in the Toronto Disaster Relief Coalition, which focused on the human cost of government austerity in housing for shortages in Toronto, and on the relationship between those issues and issues of the war economy and the need to focus on human needs and get away from the focus on war. Right up until 2000, when he was arrested, not for the first time, but for I think at least the fourth time, for an act of civil disobedience, trying to take a sword off a sword and cross memorial on an Anglican church in Toronto with a couple of other peace activists. So it was sort of before, during, and after his career as a politician. He was always focused on issues of peace and justice. So it's a big loss for us and for various movements, but he's left an important legacy to carry on.
I saw a whole lot of people talking about him, and I'm glad you mentioned those details about his life, because it seems in the last few years we've lost a number of people who can link those two issues, the economy and the war. In a city like Hamilton especially, you see a lot of suffering, a lot of economic suffering, people not getting what they need, jobs not existing. And at the same time, the government is ramping up war preparations. It's sending jets to Eastern Europe. It's got a whole lot of things going on and big plans. So, there's money for that, and there's not money for the domestic economy. And people like your father help not only put that together, but build movements around those causes so that Canadians could take back their money and their taxes to things that benefited them, and also to get a bigger perspective on the kind of structured inequality that existed that created these situations. I'm glad that you've been able to also follow in his footsteps in many respects, and taking on issues that can be difficult and controversial.
Yeah. I mean, let me just go back. Since you mentioned the war and the economy in Hamilton, let me say that London is also a crying example of it. The federal conservatives are boasting about the biggest ever export contract in Canadian industry here in London. So the old General Dynamics plant has got this multi-billion-dollar contract to export armored vehicles to the Saudis, are already a repressive regime. But we know that these vehicles are used to put down popular uprisings in Bahrain, because the Saudis send them in to impose their version of law and order there. So this is a government which is very happy to collect money with blood on its hands, and it's very hard to counter that discourse in an economy and in a region where, as you say, people are desperate for any kind of work. And we need to keep coming back to that message that if we beat the swords into plowshares, if we turned that same economic production, the same industrial capacity towards peaceful purposes, you know, we could be producing public transit with the same money with for far better effect in the economy and far better effect for jobs. But it's a message which unfortunately all three federal parties seem to have forgotten, and they're all jumping on the bandwagon of this of war production as a so-called job producer, and it's just a big lie. It's the worst possible way to create jobs in your community, but it's fantastically profitable for the 1%, right? So, I mean, the use of our tax dollars for the war economy is, it's not just theft from all of the pockets of the working people who contribute to it. It's an extremely perverse economic policy, as well as, you know, just going towards more war and destruction around the world.
Yes, it's probably one of the most inefficient ways to create jobs that you can imagine, you know, in terms of the money spent per job created. Yeah. But there's a total lack of imagination, it would seem. I mean, you're no stranger to any of this, and you take on, like your father, some of the more difficult causes. I know, at least until recently, Palestine, for example, was one of the most difficult causes, and it still is, you know, given the fact that you try to speak up about these issues, they're going to send CSIS to your door. They're going to send the secret police, the RCMP. You're going to get all sorts of harassment. And I mean, you can tell us even more about some of the other harassment you've received. I mean, the campaign that you are working on right now on Gaza's Ark is something that has international attention. Many of our listeners are familiar with it, but not all of them. And I was just wondering if you could tell us, I guess, to start out, what is the basis of Gaza's Ark?
So Gaza's Ark is a continuation of the work of the Freedom Flotilla International Coalition, which for a number of years people have been sending boats from European ports, from Greece or from Turkey or from Cyprus, to challenge the illegal and inhumane blockade of Gaza. We're continuing that with direct action, with action where we put ourselves, you know, ourselves on boats and try and draw attention to it by being there ourselves. And as I chatted with you about some time ago, I was on one of those boats in 2011 when we were, as all the others since 2008, stopped and had our boat seized, and we were kidnapped and detained and eventually deported by the Israeli occupation forces. We also know that those voyages in 2008, there were five successful voyages. So the fact that the voyages are stopped is not our choice. It's the choice of the occupier. But what the coalition does is draws attention to the blockade of Gaza and the lack of freedom of movement of Palestinians more broadly. So this time what we're doing is we're continuing to challenge the blockade, but this time from the inside out. So we've been rebuilding a boat in Gaza for the last year, an old fishing boat, which is, the families that owned it can't earn a living with fishing anymore because of the blockade. So they sold it to us. We've been refitting it, getting it ready for an ocean voyage, and at the same time finding international buyers for exports. So we want to make the focus not on the idea that Palestinians in Gaza need aid from the outside, though they do, but really what they need is freedom of movement to run their own sovereign economy. And we want people to be, instead of thinking of what we can send to Palestine, thinking of what Palestinians in Gaza can send to us. They do have a productive capacity in their economy. A lot of it has been destroyed by the occupation and, you know, by Israeli aggression. But they do have the capacity to export some things, and we're excited about finding buyers in Canada, in the States, in Australia, in Europe, in South Africa, for these contracts, to say the people who have confidence in the Palestinian economy and in their ability to support themselves without humanitarian aid are buying their export products. So we were this spring getting ready, getting towards the end of the rebuilding process. Of course, rebuilding anything in a place like Gaza under blockade is pretty challenging. But as of this spring, we were getting towards the end of the rebuilding process, beginning to fill the cargo space, talking about a test sail to make sure that everything was shipshape and ready for the voyage, when we had a very unfortunate incident on the towards the end of April, on the 29th of April, early in the morning.
Right. And I imagine this is the what you're sending out in all the media releases and the emails to subscribers and things like that. This is the sabotage of the Ark itself.
Yeah, exactly. So not for the first time. Again, voyages, people in sailing in the waters of the Eastern Mediterranean are used to the fact that these are risky voyages. As I say, sometimes we're attacked openly, sometimes we're attacked not so openly. But we were the victim, the boat was a victim of sabotage on the 29th of April with explosives attached underwater, blew two big holes in the hull, so it sank at its mooring in the port. And it, you know, it took a number of days to get it pumped out and pulled out of the water. It's now been investigated by the authorities, and we're getting ready to fix it up to sail again. It's a setback. It's not entirely unpredictable. We know that there's no place you can hide in Gaza, right? The whole place is under surveillance all the time. So we've known since the beginning that there are risks. Our attitude is that the best security for this kind of thing is to be internationally visible. And unfortunately, it took an incident like this with sort of reckless violence on the part of whoever planted these bombs to bring it to the attention of the world media. Unfortunately, not the Canadian media so much, apart from outlets like your own, but absolutely in terms of European press, the people suddenly noticed it, and in the region, the Middle Eastern press, suddenly took much more notice of what we were doing, because clearly this little boat, you know, 25 meters, 50 cubic meters of cargo space, clearly the idea of exporting Palestinian agricultural products and, you know, embroidery and crafts is very threatening to somebody, because they had to plant a bomb on it to stop it.
Yeah, in fact, if I recall the story right, wasn't it the case that there was the night watchman was there, and then he received the phone call, and they said that they were going to bomb or blow up the boat or something?
Yeah, exactly. So this is a signature of sort of a modus operandi that the occupier has used before, where they call and warn somebody that a bombing is coming. And for example, when people have their homes bombed in Gaza, sometimes there's these warning calls from the occupier, who likes to call themselves the most moral army in the region, though of course they aren't. You know, there's this idea that, oh well, if we let you know that we're going to destroy your home or your business or your property, that's okay. Whereas, I mean, the idea that an occupier can at will say, you know, this boat will be destroyed, or this home or this factory or this farm will be destroyed, is completely egregious. I mean, it's an injustice, and it's in a violation, for example, of the Geneva Convention, which is that an occupier has the responsibility to allow an occupied people to carry on, you know, their normal life and their normal economic activities. And there's no, obviously, a little boat that's going to export agricultural products and crafts from the refugee camps isn't a threat to anybody's security. So while we don't actually have a smoking gun at this point that says who did it, we do know, I mean, everybody is aware whose interest it is to stop this boat from sailing, who has sabotaged boats before, before. So the authorities are still investigating. You know, they're taking, they're doing a thorough job of investigating the damage and the artifacts that were found at the site by divers underneath the hull. So we're not going to anticipate what the Palestinian authorities in Gaza say about it at this point, but we do know that there's only one power in the region that resorts to this kind of sabotage to stop voyages like ours, and which has an interest in preventing the Palestinians of Gaza from exercising their human right of freedom of movement.
Mm-hmm. I think this is something you've seen or heard about before, at least on that Freedom Flotilla. I mean, how
Absolutely.
Many boats were sabotaged there? Wasn't there at least two boats?
There was a couple in 2011 that had the same damage on their propeller shafts, one in a Turkish port, one in a Greek port. And again, this idea that Israel can act with impunity in other people's waters to create this damage. And then later they'll boast about, oh, we stopped the boats before they left or something like that. So there, you know, we're not, as I say, we're not making a claim. We're not anticipating what the Palestinian authorities in Gaza will say when they complete their report. But I think world opinion is quite aware of whose interest it is to stop this voyage, and who has done things like this before. Because even 2011 wasn't the first time. I mean, back to the Free Gaza voyages in 2008, there were different acts of sabotage in different ports trying to stop us, or trying to stop people like us, people like this movement, to reach out to the Palestinians of Gaza. Well, and you really have to think, if a little boat like this is such a threat, why is it that nonviolent, civil disobedient, direct action is such a threat to a power which is, you know, certainly the largest military in the region and one of the most powerful militaries in the world?
Yeah, why is it a threat? I guess the idea of a Gaza, Palestinians that can trade and have their own economic relations, be independent economically, sovereign, that is a threat, I think, to the occupation itself.
Absolutely. The occupation, it depends, and this is one of the hidden sides of it. It depends economically on literally a captive market. I mean, the Palestinians of Gaza cannot trade freely with the world. What little trade they do is at the whim of the occupier, and they're forced to buy most of, you know, the aid that's sent, a lot of it passes through Israel. So the Israel literally profits directly from the occupation of Gaza, the continuing occupation of Gaza. Even though they've redeployed their troops to the perimeter most of the time, they still have regular armed incursions and shell and so forth and kill people in Gaza, and they still control directly or indirectly everything in and out. So they do very well off the occupation, off buying and selling to what the Palestinians need to buy. And obviously it's a threat to that economic interest if Palestinians assert their independent sovereign economy, and especially if they do so by the sea route, because if they have control over their sea route, that means they would control their own territorial waters, which include part of the gas beds, which Israel is currently exploiting. Part of those gas beds in the Mediterranean Sea are Palestinian territorial waters. So, you know, that's a very large economic interest, which Israel is usurping for itself in Palestinian waters. And, of course, not having boats or any kind of international commercial navigation through there means whatever they're doing is invisible to international eyes.
Right. No, and of course, that's why your eyes and the eyes of the internationals there are so important. And of course, you knew there were going to be setbacks. There always are, as you know, from the Freedom Flotilla and the sabotage there. So, I mean, this isn't the kind of thing that you let slow you down too much. I guess you guys are already taking some actions. I saw on the website there was like a press conference you organized in London. I guess that's already taken place?
That happened last week, we met with our Freedom Flotilla partners, most of whom are European, we had a press conference in London to let the world know that this kind of attack, precisely as you said, this kind of attack isn't going to stop us. It may set us back, you know, a few months while we repair it. We've already begun raising funds, and our supporters and some new supporters, some old supporters, have been very generous with the funds needed to repair these two gaping holes and the other damage from the explosions. I would say the heightened interest in making sure that we do sail, if not, this spring, then early in the fall, that we do sail, and we sail with as many people's eyes on the voyage as possible, and with lots of people symbolically on board through their purchases. I think this is another interesting thing about turning the voyage around and making it from an inside out. It's rather difficult for people to get on board physically. You know, there's not a lot of room on a small boat in the Eastern Mediterranean, and Gaza's not the easiest point of departure to travel to. But people can share the risk financially by saying, I'll buy some of that cargo. And there are different purchasing groups throughout the coalition countries and here in Canada who are putting together, you know, group purchases to say, we'll share some of the risk, not our personal bodily risk, but our financial risk by having confidence in the Palestinian economy and buying some of that cargo. So that's something that lots of people can get on board with.
Yeah, wondering how can people actually, like right now, if you're listening, can you do that through the Gaza Arc website?
You can have a look at it at the gazaarc.org/products. There's a list of products, and there's an email there, which is products@gazaarc.com. We're not really doing it as an individual purchase. There's an organization in the States which is doing some individual sales. What we're doing in Canada is sort of grouping them into community groups or organizations or associations. So I don't know if your listeners in Hamilton want to get together and do it, or they can group together with us in London. We're very flexible in that way. And we now have some time in June to put together different kind of community groups who want to get involved in joining us on this voyage with their purchases.
Maybe the sponsoring organizations can bring this up at the event tonight, which is related to some of the subject matter, and I'll discuss
Absolutely.
That afterwards. I know Noam Chomsky has also made some comments about this latest act of sabotage. That's on the website too, right?
It is. Statement by Chomsky about the sabotage of Gaza's Arc. There's a nice little one-minute video. Of course, Chomsky has been following the flotilla efforts to challenge the blockade of Gaza for a long time. And he comments on sort of the courage and steadfastness of the Palestinians who were accompanying here. And that's, I think, the most important thing about this voyage, to remember that this isn't about, you know, me sailing towards Gaza or you sailing towards Gaza or the ability of anybody international to to sail there or travel there. It's nice to be able to accompany them. But the most important issue there is their freedom of movement, the freedom of Palestinians to travel and trade freely from the only port on the Mediterranean which is closed to navigation.
And that's what solidarity means. It means how can we help enable the people in Palestine to live out their lives, to create the kind of society that they want to have according to their economic needs, their social needs, and so on. So it's really good to see this kind of this international support, this extending an arm to help them become more independent and to join the world community. And, you know, Gaza's Ark, in that respect, it's the kind of refreshing activism we want to see, to see new ways in which we can have justice for Palestine and do so as Canadians, as people in the European Union, United States, and so on. And I know there's always difficulties involved, but you've been paving the way with this and other initiatives the whole time. So, listen, I want to thank you very much for being on the program. People can go to the Gaza Ark website that you said, that's gazaark.org.
Yep.
Is there anywhere else or any contact information or anything you want to put out there as to where people can get further information or how they should participate in efforts like this one?
Most of the information is on the website, and you can write to us. The contact is there, info@gazaark.org, or if it's specifically about products, products@gazaark.com. Follow us, bring it up with your associations, with your unions, with your community groups, and with your elected officials. I mean, I think the biggest difference that we notice between our European friends in the coalition and here, and even the Australians in here, is that elected officials in North America are really afraid of the word Palestine. You know, they either won't talk to us at all, or they quietly shut the door and whisper when you say Palestine, except for three MNA, the members of the National Assembly in Quebec, from Quebec Solidaire, who are the only elected officials at that level anywhere in Canada who will talk about Palestine with us and who have endorsed this. So, you know, total respect to Françoise David, Amir Kadir, and Manon Massé. But everybody else, we need to keep bringing it up with them and saying, hey, if Canadians are buying products, Canadians want their exports to get here from Palestine, why is it that neoliberal governments and who believe in free trade want free trade with everybody in the world, but they won't facilitate free trade from Palestine to Canadians who want to buy their products? And that's something we have to keep bringing up, because that blockade of Gaza and the occupation of Palestine in general, those continue because our governments are complicit. So this is a change. This is an action we're doing in the Eastern Mediterranean with a small boat, but it's really a platform to talk about our government's support for it and to change minds here in our communities, and in our own governments.
Great. And there's something we can all bring up with our MPs. We should be speaking with them on this issue and the related issues. So, again, thanks very much, David.
Thanks so much, Brendan. Always a pleasure to speak to you.
Okay. Bye-bye.